The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. So good evening, everyone. Nice to come back and sit with you. So as Jim said, I've been at Spirit Rock for the last month, teaching a month-long retreat, and ended yesterday morning. And it's quite a profound thing to be involved in a month-long silent meditation retreat. And a lot happens in an environment where nothing happens. It's quite rare for people to spend a month in silence in their life. Some people were there for 2 months, and it's quite rare to be engaged in the process of meditation day after day, hour after hour. And one of the things that happens on a month-long retreat is, I think it happens any dedicated meditation practice, but one of the things that happens very clearly in that kind of retreat is people get to meet themselves. And you get to meet yourself really well. And some people are surprised that who they meet. There are people, there was one person who came there with the intention to do deep jhana work, deep concentration work, really get concentrated. And she met her mother, or her image of her mother, her relationship with her mother. Actually, there were a lot of mothers there at the retreat. It was kind of remarkable. The people who brought with them unresolved issues from their life that had to somehow be dealt with and met and worked with. Without somehow meeting that and working through it, they couldn't go deeper into the path, into the practice. And some people met their attitudes. They met their attitudes about themselves. And there were all kinds of attitudes that got in the way of being able to meditate. Because to have an active attitude, to hold an attitude that we're kind of using to kind of see ourselves through the world, the mind has to be busy, has to be activated. And in order to get calm, the mind has to stop being activated. And if the attitude is really big, then it gets in the way. Some of you were here not a long time ago now, maybe 6 weeks ago. Remember I gave a talk on visiting San Quentin? Remember that? So at the last week of the retreat, it was quite unusual to have someone come just for 1 week of the retreat. But the man who leads the program in San Quentin, he came to meditate, to sit there for the last week of the retreat. And then at the end of the retreat, he came up to me and he said, "Gil, remember when you came to my class in San Quentin, the violence prevention class? And the inmates were kind of leading the class, and there was one member who'd come only 2 times. And remember, he wasn't buying it, and he was pushing back and arguing, and there was this big discussion between him and some other people in the class. And I said, "Yeah, I remember him." And remember how the other inmates said to him, "You keep taking this violence prevention class for, in 6 months you'll be teaching it." Well, so he said, well, he kept coming back. And after 6 weeks, he had a catharsis. And he broke down and he said, "You know, from the age of 9 to 14, I was abused. And in coping with that, I assumed that I took on an attitude, a persona, of being a tough guy." And he finally met that tough guy attitude enough to break through it. So this guy, Jacques, told me the story at the retreat, so it's ties to the retreat experience. But that was often the kind of some people's experience in the retreat is they had to meet their attitude they carried with them all the time. I remember there was one person whose attitude was, it's all too difficult. No matter what, it's too difficult. Or, I can't do it. It's quite remarkable. Because on the retreat, what happens on a month-long retreat, with that much ongoing practice, you get to kind of bump up against your fundamental attitudes over and over and over again. And then there are attitudes that are submerged. You don't even know you have. Maybe been repressed. And in that context, they kind of come up to the surface and you get to meet them and all that. And then there are people who came to retreat to deal with their big life issues. And the issues didn't come with them. Where did they go? There was one person who, I wasn't working with that person, another teacher was, who said that she was bored. It's maybe understandable, you know, in a retreat like that, nothing's happening. But the teacher said, oh, you know, suggested something, look at it more carefully or something, or suggest. And somehow the teacher helped the person to realize that it wasn't boredom, it was calm. and the person didn't know calm, had no experience of calm, and so it was kind of confusing, and so, you know, the label was boredom. So, I think it's often in daily life, it's really hard to see, to have the kind of clarity to see the attitudes, the beliefs, the operating principles in which we base our life on. And sometimes even saying them out loud, what they are, they can maybe seem trivial or not important or too, like pop psychology or something. But when they, or we don't see how they limit us. But when you stop to sit down and be still, you can see how these things limit us, how they're limiting. And then there has to be some meeting of that and working through that and moving through it. So at the retreat, I wrote a story, made up a story for one of my talks there. So I want to read you this story. It's called The Path. It was common for new monks and nuns to ask for instruction on the path of practice. If one of them was insistent enough about finding the path, the abbot would take them to a back corner of the monastery garden where people seldom went. There, the abbot would point out a faint pathway in amongst the bushes and trees. "You will find the path at the end of this walkway," the abbot would explain before leaving the novice to walk on alone. Intrigued, the new monastic would set off down the path. After a few minutes, the path would make a sharp turn. Rounding the corner, the novice would come up to a very large mirror that blocked further passage. Confused, the novice would stare at his or her own image in the mirror. "Maybe I've taken the wrong path," some would say. But no matter how many times they retraced their steps and started over, they would keep running into the mirror. Many of the novices would soon assume that the mirror was placed there to show the real path was in themselves, not in the external world, that they themselves were the path. With this realization, some would get frightened and run away. Others would collapse with hopelessness. After all, if the path is me, how can there be any hope? Some would stand simmering in anger. Occasionally, one of the novices would find a heavy rock to hurl at the reflection, but the rock would shatter, not the mirror. Often enough, there were those who would stand stuck in front of their own reflection, filled up with conceit of themselves somehow being the great Buddhist path. Occasionally, a novice would try to walk around the mirror by plunging into the surrounding bushes. But the bushes were impenetrable, and they would soon return to the path bloodied from the many thorns they encountered. Once in a while, a monk or nun would find next to the reflection of their mother or father. It was often an eerie sight, since the parent was not standing next to them on the path. And once in a while, the reflection would quickly become obscured by a crowd of other people. No matter how much the novice would try to make sense of the people reflected in the mirror, they would remain confused. If the monk or nun became calm enough, sooner or later, they would simply stand studying the reflection in the mirror. For a number of them, this was the first time they had really looked deeply into themselves. After a while, the more unfortunate monks and nuns would conclude that the mirror and the reflection were the end of the path. They would end up standing there for a long time. But those who remembered the abbot's claim that the path was to be found at the end of the walkway would look more closely at the reflection. If they looked carefully enough, they would have the wonderful realization that the reflection is of me. The reflection is of me, but I am not the reflection. The reflection is of me, but I am not the reflection. And if then they gently pushed at the mirror, it would give way. Like a great door, it would gently swing open. And through the new opening, the path continued into an expansive, bright, sunlit section of the garden they could never have imagined existed. There, further on, at the edge of the path, stood the abbot, holding two shovels. So what do you think of that story? Sorry? It's a riddle. The Zen master Dogen, one of the most famous Zen masters in Japanese history, said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. So as we walk the path, there is no path outside of each of us. If you're going to look for the path of practice, you won't find it at IMC, you won't find it at Spirit Rock, you won't find it in Thailand, you won't find it in the place in India where the Buddha was enlightened. The only place you can find the path is in yourself and how you walk the path. That's where it's found. It's found in you. And so there has to be some real meeting of yourself. And there's plenty of people who engage in the Buddhist path who try to avoid themselves. But sooner or later, there has to be a very honest assessment, inventory, honest meeting of who we are, what we're up to, not just in the kind of conventional activities of our life, but deep down in our hearts, deep down in our psyche, our emotions, our feelings, our attitudes, our beliefs, and most importantly, the ideas we have about who we are, our sense of self. We have to meet these things. And as we meet them, some people will have all these attitudes about what they meet. And the attitudes we have about how we meet ourselves, how we see ourselves, are an important part of the path. And so we have to kind of understand, are we for or against our own self-reflection? The image we hold ourselves in, the ideas we have, the ways we represent ourselves to ourselves, how do we relate to that? And there's a whole range of ways. Some people are basically optimistic about their self-image, and some people are pessimistic. Some people think who they are is a gift to the world, and some people think the opposite. And the whole range, you know, of ways in that manifests itself. And so we have to kind of understand that, in some what that is. And as we begin looking and understanding that, we also can begin understanding where that, we begin settling some of those, resolving some of those. So they don't keep us agitated or running away for some people. Some people are really good at running away from themselves. Some people are really good at looking, always being busy in the world, busy with activities, busy with judging other people, busy with things, so that they don't have to stop and really take an honest look here. Some people are really good at giving up and just kind of collapsing and not taking any steps on the path because their self-image is one of, I'm incapable, I can't do it. So all these, there's a whole spectrum of attitudes we have about ourselves that have to be met and looked at. And then if we settle them enough so we can look calmly, so we can be still, not in conflict with what we see. And that's really a key thing, is not to be in conflict with what we see. Really to see and look and be present really carefully. Then this magic moment can happen, or a special moment can happen, when we realize that whatever it is, the image we have of ourselves, whatever that image is, whatever the way we represent ourselves in our own mind, the way we hold ourselves, the beliefs we have about who we are, we start seeing them for what they are. They're reflections. And the reflection in a mirror has some truth to it. But the reflection, so the reflection is of you, but you are not the reflection. The reflection can't hold the fullness of who we are, all the aspects of who we are. And so to realize that there's some truth, perhaps, or there's something two-dimensional in the realm of these concepts, ideas, attitudes, feelings we have about who we are. And whatever our understanding is of who we are, that understanding is always going to be limited. And so what is that? Who are we outside of the limited view that we have? If all views are limiting and limited, well then who are we outside the views? And how would you know if you don't have a view to name it or call it? How do we relate to that part of ourselves which perhaps is outside of knowing, understanding, planning, evaluating, measuring, defending, apologizing, fixing, building up? You know, there's all this stuff that we do. So to begin, it allows us to begin to question our self-image, the sense of self, the idea of self that we carry with us as we go through the world. We begin perhaps understanding a little more about the forces in our life that helped create that sense of self we have. It's not arbitrary. It's not just the nature of the universe that you should have this particular sense of self that you have. But there are deep cultural, familial, social experiences, messages, conditioning that we get that goes into formulating something as intimate as our sense of who we are. The sense of who we are is not God-given. It's not a fixed thing, but rather something that's put together through lots and lots of experiences and feedback and messages we get growing up and beyond that. So to begin seeing that, and begin seeing it in a sense as being two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. A mirror is two-dimensional. A mirror has no depth. So how much depth do we lose when we mistake ourselves for our image of ourselves, for our idea of who we are? And perhaps there's some truth in the idea. We don't want to dismiss the idea, the ideas we have entirely. The mirror is accurate enough. But the mirror is only two-dimensional. It's only part of the picture. And so then to be able to look calmly or without agitation, without being for or against the self-image, the ideas we have, whether it's a bad self-image or a good self-image, just to look at it, be present, feel it, see it, and not be fooled by it, or not be pulled into its orbit, not to be pulled into its kind of magical world, not to be tricked by it to believe that's who I really am. You know, if a magician does a magic trick, it can be fascinating no matter how long, how many times we see it. It's a really good magic trick. Wow, look at that, look at that. But if the magician shows you how the magic is done, you get bored pretty quickly. What about the magic of the mind? When you get to see how the magic of the mind is done, the sense of self arises and is created and holds us in its enchantment, and you see how that magic is done, then we get bored or we lose interest or we begin interest in something else. But we have to stay there. We can't turn away. Be present. And so then in the story, at some point, gently, and the word gently is very important in the story, gently, they gently push against the mirror. And the mirror just gives way. I would have liked, actually, in the story, if the mirror just kind of dissolved into thin air. But that wouldn't have been very realistic. So the mirror just kind of swings away, just kind of gives away parts. And, you know, this two-dimensional image that we have, ideas we have, just kind of give away. And into something which, a world which is three-dimensional. And in this kind of pastoral way of in the story, it opens up. And through the new opening, the path continued into an expansive, bright, sunlit section of the garden they could never have imagined existed. You never could have imagined existed. So, but the path continues. It isn't like that is the end of the path. You know, the garden, beautiful sunlit garden. The path continues. And in the first version of the story, I put the abbot on the path, waiting on the other side. But then I thought, oh no, if I put the abbot on the abbot will be confused for the path, for the end of the path. So I moved him. Then further on, at the edge of the path, stood the abbot, holding two shovels. Now, why do you think he's holding two shovels? So now that's your turn. That's the riddle part. Who would? Two shovels.
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 That's to put the self-image in.
To dig a grave and bury it. Okay, so it's to make a dig a grave for the self-image and leave it behind.
That's a graven image.
A graven. Yes.
Continue.
Ah, so to continue making the path. At some point, the path runs out of paths, so then you have to use your shovel to make more. Great. Okay, that's nice. Thank you. Okay. Yes, Ruth.
They are putting the body in the ground, the self, and they're going to water it and fertilize it, and something is going to grow from that.
Beautiful. So they're going to bury the body, the self-image, the image. And then you're going to bury it and cover it and water it, and some beautiful things can grow up out of it.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much. I never imagined that these more morbid ideas. but I'm very much appreciating it. That's just so good.
Then they go work for the mafia, burying bodies. Then they.
Why is there two shovels, and what does the abbot
represent? It's your riddle. That's what I'm asking you. I only wrote it up to that point. Yes.
Both of you have to keep digging into the self.
Both of you have to keep digging into the...
Right.
Both of you have to keep digging. Mm-hmm. Good.
Even if you get to the end, things don't just stop right there. Life goes on. There's work to do.
So even if you get to the end, so-called end, life still goes on, so there's still more work to be done. And the work's kind of dirty, right? Shovels are kind of... Yes?
Well, I guess the two shovels are the self and the non-self.
The self and the non-self and the two shovels. Okay.
But I don't exactly understand the shovel part.
Okay. Yes, please.
It's the futility of the search.
It's the what of the search?
Fertility
of the search.
You're wasting time looking for something that isn't there.
Uh-huh.
All empty.
Yes. And the shovels, what are they used for?
You might as well dig a hole, set it up, dig a hole again.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
I don't know the two shovels, but to cover your tracks.
So she doesn't know the two shovels, but she thinks they're there to cover your tracks. When you go in the wilderness, you bring shovels with you nowadays so that you bury your own poop. You bury your own mistakes. So, okay.
So I think that each person, the shovel is one for each, and the point where you've gone past the image of yourself, you're digging, the path is sort of being made as you go.
So the path, the two shovels are one for each of them, the abbot and the novice. And once you reach that point where the image falls away, then you keep...
The path is wherever it is you're going.
The path is wherever you're going, and the shovel is what's the shovel for?
Make
more path, make the further path. Okay, great.
I think the shovel is just the appropriate tool for you to have in a garden.
The shovel represents work.
The shovel represents work. So there's no enlightened retirement.
Enlightenment is a direction.
Sorry?
Enlightenment is a direction, not a place.
Enlightenment is a direction, not a place. And so the shovels are the tools for moving on. Yes?
I think at the beginning you thought the abbot had arrived, but you realize he's got a shovel, he's still going through.
So at the beginning you think the abbot has arrived, but when you see that, you see that he's still working and moving along too. Okay? Yes?
We already sort of said this in disjunctive, but we have to prepare for death, so in a way we could be digging our grave.
We have to prepare for death, so in a way we're digging our own grave. Suzuki Roshi said that life is like being put into a boat which is going off into sea to sink. So we have to dig our own grave. Yes?
Well, if you're still alive, I suppose you take the shovel and you go build another garden.
So if you're still alive, you have to go out and build another a garden out in the world. Okay, thank you. Yes, Xinguan.
I think that to have a shovel in a garden is a gift because it's really hard to do work in a garden without a shovel.
So to have a garden and a shovel is a gift because it's hard to do work in the garden without a shovel. So the abbot's giving him a gift. Great, thank you. Yes?
Well, the shovel is a red herring. It's nothing, it's just there.
No. You see, in Zen, they teach that everything is significant. Everything matters. There's no red herrings.
They take you off the path.
Sorry?
They take you off the path.
Nothing.
Being on the shovel, so...
The shovel can take you off the path if you focus on the shovel instead of the path. Why the shovel? So, like, you know, they don't mistake the finger for the moon, they say in Zen. So don't mistake the shovel for the path. Yes?
What is dig yourself in, dig yourself out?
The shovel is to dig yourself in or to dig yourself out? Yes, please.
Once you have arrived at the garden, it's time to tend it.
Once you've arrived at the garden, it's time to tend it. Okay, thank you. Just behind you, yeah.
I was just curious, how did the animals get there? Maybe the way they got there, the shovel was to go back and help others come to the other side.
Oh, okay. So once the novice has gotten there, his job is to go back and help other people find that path or make a path for other people to do the same thing. Yeah, beautiful. Yes, Ruth.
I shouldn't say this. But with a shovel, I'm going to dig a hole and put myself in there.
Uh-huh.
And not red herrings, but worms I'll meet. And by getting involved with them, a new life will come again. Mm. Compost. Body compost.
Yeah.
I was
going to
say something.
Yes, so she is.
Turning the soil over and putting all the bull, you know, from living a life of a false image and then creating new flowers and fruit as you plow and turn the soil over. The compost that comes from living a false image.
Uh-huh. So it's a nice idea that all our false images and delusions can be become compost for something beautiful to arise. So rather than dismissing it, nothing gets dismissed, but everything gets addressed and worked with and allowed to be transformed into something else. So it takes a lot of honesty to do that, because you have to really see what's there and look at it and be very still when we look. So one of the things that I think is very important to learn, especially if you do a month-long retreat, is how to be very attentive, learn to pay careful attention to what's happening, and then learn how to, no matter what it is, to learn how to be still in that alertness, to be still with what's happening, to rest in the middle of whatever is your experience. So you have to have both. And I kind of liken it to the vitality and stillness of a candle flame that unflickering in the wind. You know, if you look at the candle flame, it's completely still. There's no wind. But it's really dynamic in there. So the alertness, the clarity of the mind that really sees is the dynamic part. And then the still flame is that ability to be at rest or be really still, really quiet, just to be there. And sometimes it's a hard task to learn. If there's a lot of fear deep inside, or a lot of anger, or a lot of sadness, to really be there and then be really still, to rest in the middle of it, not before or against it, just there. And then see what that transforms into in its own time. Or to have a lot of joy and to sit there, be very still with the joy. Rest in the middle of the joy. Not kind of caught in it or being pushed around by it or delighting in it, but just really there, still. Very present for it. And be still. So this capacity to be really present and to be still. Really present and to find the place of rest in whatever our experience is. And that's a big task. It's depending on how challenging the inner life, the inner images or issues there that come up. For some people on the retreat, the really big mirror that they encountered, they really, you know, they maybe encounter a lot of small mirrors all along the retreat, but the really big mirror where they really met themselves was at the end of the retreat when they started talking. And they're actually, it's somewhat common in long retreats like that for people to be surprised how quickly their personality comes back. And it's actually a very important thing to see, because normally people go through life thinking their personality is who they are and just the way things are, and they don't question it. But and on retreat, the personality slowly, bit by bit, falls away. Or the usual ways, habitual ways of operating and talking and being concerned and all that falls away, quiets down, quiets away. Sometimes it's so slow that people aren't even aware that it's dropping away. And but then when people start talking, it can rush back. And it affects not only how their mind thinks and feels, but it even affects their sense of how their experience of their own body, the tensions and stuff in their own body. And then to see that contrast is an opportunity for a lot of wisdom. And one of the wisdom is to see that our much of what we call our personalities, not all of it, but much of it, is the software and not hardware. And if we start seeing it as software, then we can put a question mark after it. Oh, maybe it doesn't have to be this way. Maybe there's another way of relating to it. Maybe there's other software. Maybe there's an upgrade. So I hope that you get to your shovel. Hope someone gives you a shovel someday. And until then, until you get the shovel, I hope you find that mirror. And I hope you now learn how to be present for what you see and to be calm, to be still, to rest with what you see until you see that whatever self-image you have is of you, but you are not it. So, thank you so much.